Think about how he was introduced, but he sure wanted to get here in time for those steaks the other night. This is a prime thing. He didn't care much about how he was introduced. Actually, he's no stranger to Oregon AA. He has many friends throughout the state. He's been here quite a few times. He was our main speaker at the Grants Pass Conference in 1960, and as such is actually, he's helping us celebrate our 10th anniversary of our present conference structure. For those of us who have heard Chuck before, he needs no introduction. For those of us who are about to hear him for the first time, no introduction can do justice. So, let's give a big Oregon welcome to our friend and fellow member from Laguna Beach, California, Chuck C.
Thank you. I'm Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi. About the only worry I ever have when I come on one of these junkets is if the committee that asked me is going to break even. This always worries me. But I don't know how they've arranged their finances, but if we can't get a little dough out of this outfit, we're not very good. This is quite a gathering. Being an old fire horse, I attended the business session this afternoon. There were a couple of meetings that I really wanted to go to, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity of going to your General Assembly. And I have to congratulate the whole state of Oregon. I think that I sat in the best informed General Assembly that I have ever sat in this afternoon. I saw one of the most beautiful examples of sharing and working together that I've seen in my lifetime. And I was most happy to have been privileged to watch it. I am certain in this great Commonwealth of Oregon, there are many men and many women who would be capable I'm doing a fine job as a delegate or as a state chairman or as a treasurer or most anything else that Alcoholics Anonymous needs. But I suspect that in the business this afternoon, the selections that were made were tops. I doubt if anybody in the state of Oregon would do you a better job than the people that were elected this afternoon. And I was glad to be there to see it. I'm glad to be here tonight. I haven't quite figured out why, but I am. I'm glad to be here. And I'm very glad you're here. I always think that when you go a long ways to talk, it's nice if somebody comes to listen. So I want to thank you all for coming. I am certain that you know as I do that I am not here because of the great success I have made out of my life. On the contrary, I am here because of the great failure I made out of my life. And I don't ever expect to forget it. At the ripe old age of 43, I was a failure in every department of life. Failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. At 43. Now, I take credit for that. During those first 43 years, I was a master of ceremonies and I was the star of the show. So I take all the credit for my first 43 years and none for the second 23 years and 8 months. I can take no credit for living long enough to get to my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can take no credit for coming, because as long as I had choice, my choice was never to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. By this time in my life, I did not have a very high regard for the human race. I thought it was a cosmic mistake. I didn't even like the good people, and the drunks I hated, because I was a drunk and I hated me, so I hated all drunks. And the very idea of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was absolutely obnoxious to me. And I never came as long as I had choice. But if you happen to be an alcoholic, and if you happen to be still nipping a bit, be not discouraged. The time will come when you ain't got no choice. And there won't be any place else to go. And if you live long enough, you too will be here. And that time happened to me in January 1946. It didn't happen. It didn't happen very fast. I drank for 25 years. The first 15 years, I would call good drinking. Now, just quickly, I've got to sort of qualify that. I doubt very much if any alcoholic ever had any good drinking. I doubt it. So we'd have to say, compared with what? Like the two drunks you know that met, one of them says, "How's your wife?" He says, "Compared with what?" So, my first 15 years of drinking compared with my last 10 were wonderful. They were good drinking years. I got drunk in my first 15 years on purpose. But I didn't get drunk when it wasn't on purpose. In my early years, I can't even remember that we said to each other, "Let's have a drink." I don't think we ever did. We said to each other, "Let's get drunk tonight." And we set about just to do that, and we did it. But when we got drunk, that was it. We didn't stay drunk. And we didn't get drunk by accident. And I had a very strict code for drinking, just as I had a strict code for everything else in life. And I drank according to my code. But after 15 years, I woke up to the fact that I was not drinking according to my code. One of the things that I had not done all my life was sup with a client with liquor on my breath. I was entirely opposed to that kind of performance, and I never did it. But I woke up to the fact that this I was doing, that I wasn't drinking well. And so I sat down with me, and I diagnosed my case. And I saw that this was a weakness that I had to overcome. I did not think that total abstinence was the answer. I thought that any weakling could drink it. But it took a pretty good hand to meet it head on and defeat it. Which I was going to do. Because I figured that's the only way I could get rid of it. And I started 10 years before I came to this program working on my problem. And I worked on it 10 years. And the harder I worked, the worse it got. And the worse it got, the harder I worked. And I'm quite sure that in the last 5 years, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. And it got worse all the time. Well, now to show you how difficult it was for me to come to this program. On my next to the last drunk, I was a periodic for the last 10 years. Again, on purpose, because, you see, I was dedicated to winning this little battle. And you can't put up a very good fight when you're down on your back. So I became a periodic in order to get well enough to get back in the ring for the next round. And I had been sober for some time. And I had planned a little trip back to the hill country where I was born with our oldest son. He'd never been back to that country. And he was going into the Navy. And so we planned a little trip together. I was going to carry him on back there and we were going to have a little vacation together. And it came the day, and I left the office with money in my pocket and feeling fine. And I was just going home to pack and head out on the road. Well, of course, it was vacation, and I picked up a pint. Mind you, I'd been sober for quite a little while. So I got me a pint, and I drank it on the way home. Well, I still had to pack, so I got me another pint. And while I was packing, I put that away. And Bill was already in the car, ready to go, and I came out with my suitcase, and Bill says, "Dad, you're drunk." "Why," says I, "am not, ha-ha. I've had a couple of drinks, but this is a vacation. We're going to have fun. Let's get going." He said, "No, Dad." He says, "You're drunk. And I'm not going with you." And I argued with him, and nothing would change his mind. He got out and took his grip and went in the house. Well, hell, he couldn't do that to his dear old dad. So I went without him. I filled his spot up with a good substitute. And I headed east. Well, I don't remember very much about that trip. I remember maybe the first night out, second night out, I don't know. I came to in the middle of the night. And it was very, very dark. There was one light. It was the headlight of a locomotive. And it was going right across the front end of my car. And the whistle was blowing and the bell was ringing. And I said to me, "You're on the railroad track." But there's nothing I could do about it. So I just sat there, and the train went by right by the nose of my car. And as soon as that light was the other side, oh, it was dark. It was awful dark. And, of course, that's a rather nerve-wracking experience. And I couldn't see anything, so there was only one thing to do, and that was to reach under the seat and pull out that fifth and do a little drinking. Settle my nerves. Which I did. And eventually it became daylight, and I cased the joint, and you couldn't get where I was. I mean, there was no way. I was down at the bottom of the canyon, I presume, in Arizona or New Mexico, someplace down there. 500 or 600 yards off the highway, and there was no road down there. And in as much as you couldn't even get down there, it was impossible to get out. And so there was nothing else to do but drink. Which I did. Well, the next time I came to, I was in the pokey. It was the least little jailhouse I was ever in my life. There was only one cell, and I had it. And there was nobody else in the whole building. I mean, everybody going home. And again, it was the middle of the night. But this time, I couldn't reach into the seat. So I had to sweat it out there till somebody came, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. And the first guy that showed up was a highway patrolman who had captured me. And he came in with my bottle. Incidentally, it was about 2/3 full. But he wouldn't give it to me. And he told me that he'd had a little rough time capturing me. He said that I was driving on the wrong side of Highway 66, scattering traffic like pigeons. And when he fell in behind me, I thought that was a great challenge, and I took off, really. But he caught me all right, and he had me there in the pokey. And when the town fathers came and held court on me, I found out I was in southern Illinois. Well, evidently, I had driven out of that place just like I drove down there. Because nobody had ever pulled me out and let me go. I know that. But I had to get out some way because I'm in southern Illinois. Well, to make a long story short, I bought my way out. $107 and a half and a very good alcoholic story. I was going back to see my dear old dad. So, I was on my way again. Well, I remember being home. My father and mother were pretty old already. And I remember them trying to talk with me, and of course they couldn't. I was drunk. I not only visited my dad and mother, but all the rest of my people. They tell me. And again, to make a long story short, I eventually got home. And I suspect I had the same air in my tires that I had when I left. Now, isn't that strange? I had driven 6,000 miles, 95% of it in a dead black blackout. And I got back out here with the same air in my tires, as far as I know. And I went to bed to finish my drunk. Now, in my last 5 or 6 years, I always finish my drunks in bed. It's very comfortable. In bed, you don't have to do anything but drink. And you never get up for any reason whatsoever except to replenish your supply. And for those of you who don't know, there are other reasons to get out of bed. drinking as long as I could replenish my supply. But when I was done in completely and couldn't even lift my head off the pillow, Mrs. Seed had to lift my head up to put a little liquid in my mouth, I would have to quit. Because nobody would bring me anything to drink. They didn't understand me. And so this time came, and I had to quit, and I did. And maybe it's 24 hours after my last drink that I'm able to get up and go to the kitchen for a glass of buttermilk. And I went out to the kitchen for a glass of buttermilk, and Mrs. C and Dick were sitting in the living room, and they heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. And thinking that I was in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my wont, they came trotting out the kitchen. But I wasn't having a convulsion. I wasn't having anything. I was just lying on the kitchen floor, as peaceful as anybody you ever saw, doing nothing. They tell me I was a very peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. And always at this point, I have a peculiar sense of humor. I laugh when everybody else bawls, and I bawl when everybody else laughs. And so as serious as this thing is, I get a tremendous kick out of it. Because I remember the many times when I was coming off of drunk, when everybody in town was looking for me, 90% of them just to tell me they never wanted to see me again. Now, this just tickles my funny bone. Why in the hell didn't they leave us alone if they never wanted to see us again? But no, they had to run us down just to tell us they never wanted to see us again. And I'm sure my wife and kids have been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. And they come to the kitchen and found me dead. And they get all exercised. So they get the oxygen squad down there from the Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital. And they finally brought me around. And I remember there was a young doctor with them, and he told me, he said, to all intents and purposes, you were dead. And he says, we had a tough time bringing you around, and in our opinion, nobody will ever be able to bring you back again. So he told me that if he were me, he wouldn't do that anymore. It seems like they were a gimmick. Well, it might have been another 24 hours when I was well enough to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking up and down the living room floor. This is the only way I ever knew to sober up. I had never heard of an easy way to sober up until I got to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And then it was too late for me. The only way I ever sobered up was just to die till I could live. And so I got the old bathrobe on, and I'm going up and down the living room floor, sweating, freezing, shaking, dying, and walking. And we had a corner fireplace. Mrs. C was standing over the fireplace. And I was walking away from her, and I remembered as if it were yesterday. And she said to me, Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous? And I turned on her like a lion. I said, you, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks. I, who have read all the good books for the good authors. And you want me to... Why, I said, you wound me deeply. See, I'd just been dead 24 hours before. You wound me deeply. And I polished her off completely by saying, and besides, I can write a better book than that myself. So you see, it wasn't easy for me to come here. I was still saying to myself, 10 years after I'd lost this battle, I'll beat this thing if it's the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last thing I ever did. And so again, had it been possible for me to survive in left field, I would still be there. But it was no longer possible for me to survive after my last bout. I'll just give you the highlights in that, and then we'll sneak ahead. I was sober from that day that I told you about until this probably was the latter part of September 1945. And I never had a drink until the Friday before Christmas, 1945. And on the Friday before Christmas, my then boss man called me in. And he said, Charlie, I'm Charlie in business and Chuck in AA. That's the way I keep my calls separated. I come in and my girl gives me a whole handful of calls. She says, these are Chuck calls. And she gives me one and she says, this is a Charlie call. So he says to me, Charlie, he says, you've had a lot of trouble this year. But he didn't mention alcohol. But he knew that I knew what he was talking about when he said trouble. And he, being a non-alcoholic, had it all figured out. So he told me. He says, I think it's because of the pressure you're under. Now, says he, I'm going to take a little of the pressure off of you, and maybe next year you won't have so much pressure and you won't have so much trouble. And so instead of shooting me, as he had every right to do, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. The Friday before Christmas, 1945. Well, if there's anything worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune, it's good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. This is a Friday before Christmas. Now, I don't know what you all think about drunk. I guess everybody has a different idea about what's drunk. But I have a different idea. I'll be driving down the freeway and I'll see the cops. They've got a poor guy standing over there by the side of the road, you know, giving him the stuff. And I say to myself, why in the hell are they torturing that poor guy? Obviously he's not drunk, he's standing up. You know? Now, I don't think a guy like that's intoxicated. I only heard one description or definition that ever got even close to me. And this is it. He is not drunk who from the floor can lift his head and take one more. But he is drunk who prostrate lies and can neither lift his head nor rise. Now that's me. When I say I got drunk on the way home, I did. And I don't remember that they had any Christmas that year. I don't remember that they had any New Year's that year. I don't remember anything until the latter part of January. 1946. I came to one morning in the latter part of January with the clearest head I've ever had in my entire lifetime. Now, this is amazing because it couldn't happen. but it did. If my wife were telling you this story, she would tell you that when I went to bed to drink, I drank 7 quarts of whiskey every 3 days. Now, I don't think 7 quarts of whiskey in 3 days is very much liquor. If you just do it for 3 days. But if you do it for 3 or 4 weeks, you've drunk a lot of liquor. And she says that's what I did. I don't know. I wasn't there. She was. I never ate when I drank. And so I had nothing in my skin at all but alcohol. And yet I came to with the clearest head I have ever known in my entire lifetime. It might have lasted 15 minutes. I don't know. But the first thing that I knew was that I'd lost the battle of life. Now, this is the first time in 43 years that I had ever admitted defeat under any circumstance. And I knew, without knowing why, that I'd lost the battle of life. I also knew why my wife was divorcing me after 20 years. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. I also knew why our sons wouldn't come home when I was around, if they could help it. And I also knew why that same boss had sent word to my house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window to which he referred does not open. It's a plate glass affair. I accepted the fact that morning, completely and totally, that everything dear to me in life was gone and that I was not entitled to have it back. Now, I'm going to say that again because to me this is most important and has been for 23 years and 8 months or thereabouts in my life. I totally and completely accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life was gone and that I was not entitled to have it back. It suddenly became very necessary for me to be sober to die. Now, I knew I was going to die. I did not care. But until I died, I must be sober. For one reason, I did not want sobriety for myself. I did not want anything for myself because my life was over. But such time as I had to live, I must spend rubbing out what I'd already written on the blackboard of life. I didn't want those boys and their mother to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. And the last thing that went through my mind before the curtain came down, and I was again insane, sickened to death, and drunk. I remembered that I had read Jack Alexander's article in the Post in 1941. In March. I was 4 sheets in the wind when I read it. Mrs. C had found it and put it out on the arm of my chair, opened it to the right place. And I had read it. I remembered only 2 things. That drunks helped drunks and didn't drink. And that you called it Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I knew about the deal. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of bed, get out of this bed, I will find AA. And whambo, the curtain came down. And I had to die a lot of times. I had had the experience, as many of you have, I know, in withdrawal periods through the years of my mind coming and going like turning a light on and off. But this time my mind left and it wouldn't come back. And I was pretty sure that that last gallon was too much. The cord was broken. And that I would remain insane for the rest of my life. But, as you know, Every nerve center in my body was yelling for liquor. Every one of them. And there are a few billion, I think. But everything in me was, how long can I live without a drink? And so help me, from that second until right now, I've never had to have a drink or pill. That's 23 years and some 8 months ago. I had to die and die and die. But I didn't have to drink. Now, I didn't even know where to find this society. It never occurred to me that it was in the phone book. So, how was I going to find it? Well, the only way I knew was to call people and ask them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Which I did. And in due course of time, I got a telephone number from a doctor in Beverly Hills, one of our members, and I called him. And he happened to be a picture man. And when I talked with him a little bit and established the need, he says, "Have you had a drink today?" And I said, "No." Well, he says, "Don't take one." He says, "I'm working nights. And I can't take you to a meeting tonight, so call me tomorrow. And maybe tomorrow night I can take you to a meeting." So, all right. So tomorrow I called him. And he says, "Have you had a drink today?" And I said, "No." He says, "Don't take one. I'm still working." "Call me tomorrow." So I called me tomorrow. I called him tomorrow. And he says, "Have you had a drink today?" And I said, "Don't give me that routine. You don't have to take me to a meeting. Where is a meeting that I can go to?" And he told me. And I went. I've never had a sponsor in this program. Except that every one of you are my sponsor. Everybody I've ever seen in Alcoholics Anonymous is my sponsor. But I never had one. I went to my first meeting alone, by myself. Now, I say by myself alone because I am often now by myself. But I'm never alone. But I guess there is nothing that is quite so alone as an alcoholic who's run out of time. And that's the way I went to that first meeting. Not knowing anything at all about you. And thinking that you might not be very reputable. Maybe I shouldn't be seen coming close by where you were meeting. So I disguised myself. I had two good garments. I had a camel's hair, gray camel's hair coat with a belt around the middle and a big collar. And I put that on. I think it's the same hat I've got upstairs with a big brim. I put that on, and I pulled that collar up around my head, and I pulled that brim down over my face, and I sallied forth. Yeah. And the meeting was on the ground floor. The Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall in Beverly Hills, at the corner of Wilshire and Santa Monica. I lived in Beverly for most of my drinking time and 11 of my sober years. First 11. And so, I walked up to that meeting maybe 5 minutes before time for it to pick up. There might have been 30 people there. And they were all standing in the middle of the room, yakking their heads off. And nobody listening to nothing. Every one of them just standing there, burp, you know. And I stood in the doorway looking at y'all. And he didn't look like me. You weren't dressed like me, and you didn't feel like me. Most certainly, you didn't talk like me. And I said to myself, they've given me the wrong dope. This is the wrong night. These are the veterans and their wives, and they're here for a party.
And I'm going to have to leave and come back tonight. The drunks are here. Now, I was dead when I got there, but I was 10 feet under when I turned to leave. And somebody inside there had been looking at me. And I turned to leave, and he came trotting over to the door, and he called to me. And he says, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." And he says, "Well, what were you looking for?" And thinking it was a veteran, I said, "Well, sir, if it would interest you, I was looking for sobriety." And the guy lit up like a Christmas tree. Now, this is the miracle of AA right here. This is it. Without this, no recoveries whatsoever. This is the thing itself. Here's a man whom I had never seen before in my entire lifetime, a total and complete stranger to me, who was glad I was there. Enough so that he lit up like a Christmas tree. Well, now, everybody that I knew was glad I was there, too. But for an entirely different reason. Because if I was there, I couldn't be here. But this guy was genuinely glad I was there, enough that his whole being changed. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. And the next words he said were these: "Why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place." And he put his arm around me, and he took me in, and he rocked me to sleep. Now, that's the miracle of AA. That's it. Without this, no recoveries at all. So I decided that night I wanted what you had and became willing to go to any length to get it. But I left the meeting with a great fear upon me. The fear that I couldn't have this thing, that I didn't have enough left to get it. But I wanted it more than anything in life. And I was back to a meeting every night of the week for 6 months with this great fear upon me that I couldn't have it. Now, I never had a sponsor, as I told you. I didn't even ask questions because I didn't think I was entitled to any consideration whatsoever. Nothing. And so I became an eavesdropper. And as soon as I could hold a cup of coffee without spilling it all over myself, I would get it, and I would spot somebody that seemed to be talking good AA. And I'd back up to him with this coffee, you know, and stick my ear into the conversation. And if they caught me, I'd take off and back up to somebody else. And if they caught me and included me in, I couldn't take it. So I'd go out under the pepper trees and bawl like a baby. I couldn't believe that anybody cared that much. And so I did 6 months of this. At which time I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been for 6 months. And this was the first awakening in Alcoholics Anonymous. I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been for 6 months. And this is the first time that I talked to Mrs. C. about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, in those first 6 months, I wasn't talking to her about anything. Because she was done getting rid of me legally, you know. So we weren't what you call communicating. Heard them up there in the business meeting trying to talk to each other about communicating. We didn't have any. So when I discovered I was sober, I had to talk to her. I had to talk to everybody, and I've been talking ever since. I mean, what the hell? Let's face it. I haven't shut up yet. And it's 23 years since I discovered this. So I started talking to Mrs. C, and I found that she had already read my book about four or five times. She knew more about my book than I did. And she asked me to take her to a meeting, which I did. And she's still going with me. So, that ain't bad. Now, I said that was the first awakening. And quickly, I'm going to give you a little series of awakenings, because I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's a matter of uncovering, discovering, and discarding. It's a series of awakenings that start and keep going forever, as long as we walk in this way. The first one was that I was sober. The second one was that something had happened in the household. We weren't... gotten to an AA meeting because I had to. The man had paid me for something I hadn't done. And I knew that he was going to throw me through the window. But I couldn't help it. I had to go. And I did. And he saw my old battered up car out there, and he came in fully intent on throwing me through the window. He came through the door like a bull in a china closet, and fortunately for me, I was on the telephone. That was his phone and his frugal man. So while I was finishing the conversation, he moved my drafting boards out from in front of the window, and I hung up the phone and he started after me. Well, I couldn't have defended myself. I couldn't hardly walk. I wasn't in robust health. I'd just been drunk for 4 months. I mean, 4 weeks, not 4 months. That was it. So the only thing I could say to him was, Victor, leave me alone. Don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that it didn't do. And as soon as I get even with you, I'll get the hell out of here on my own power, and you'll never owe me a penny as long as you live, but for God's sake, leave me alone. I've got to get even with you. And he stopped in his tracks. And he says, what's happened to you, Charlie? And I says, don't know. And I didn't. But he knew something had happened. So I said, sit down, and I'll tell you what I do know. And he sat down, and he got up an hour later, and he's crying like a baby. And he stuck out his hand, and he says, Charlie, if you're going to live like that, I want to live with you. And that's the way that started. And here I am, the third awakening. I'm still down there trying to clean up a desk, and things are going good. And the next one was that something had happened to my state of being. I was not only physically sober, but things had happened inside me. My state of being was much, much better than it had ever been. And that wasn't too bad. And it might have been then 4 or 5 years that the great discovery, which is a partial discovery, as we all know, because you never stop in this program. It's a journey, you know. It's not a destination. About maybe 4 or 5 years, I woke up to the fact that I had a God of my very own, that I was never alone again, that wherever I was, he was my own God. And those are a pretty nice series of discoveries. And that's what this program is all about. The discovering ourselves and our relationship to each other and to the living God that makes. Because, you see, there is no explanation for the kind of performance you and I turn in as practicing alcoholics. There was nothing in the last 10 years of my drinking that was good. I never had one good drunk in the last 10 years. Now, in my first 15 years, I could get to the point where everything was all right with me and with you and with life, and God was in his heaven and all was well with the world. But I never made that one time in the last 10 years. Everything about my life went down, 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 down in those last 10 years. But I defended my right to kill myself as if it was the finest life on the face of the earth. And so did you. There is no way that you can explain that away. That flit is not that good. You know.
It isn't the taste of it. It's not all that good. Matter of fact, there are a few alcoholics that like to taste the liquor. We like what it does for us, but the taste, most of us don't particularly care for the taste. Then why do we do it? This is the great cry of the so-called Earth people. The norms is. Why? Well, we can't tell them because we don't know ourselves. When they asked us why, we told them we didn't know, and we didn't know. Well, after 23 years of trying to walk in this way, I feel that I maybe know why. I don't know, but I've got a perfectly good explanation for me, and I accept it. I often say at the end of the meeting, the time has to come with you and with me when we say to ourselves, if there be fault, it is mine. If there be fault, it is mine. I say if there be fault because I do not believe there's fault. I do not believe there's fault. I think that you and I are victims of the combination of characteristics with which we come into this world. All of which are good after we learn how to live with them. But until we learn how to live with them, they are killers. Now, I'll have to say real quickly that I'm talking as an alcoholic, two alcoholics. But I know there are a lot of people in this room who are not alcoholics. And I must say right fast that I do not believe there's one answer for me, an alcoholic, and another one for you, a non-alcoholic. I think there's only one answer to this thing called life, and it's all the same, whether you're an alcoholic or not. And so what I have to say, I am not saying that you who are not alcoholics can't have. You can. If you want it. The second thing I want to say is that if there is one thing that I'm totally convinced of, above all others, after 23 years in this fellowship, it is that the first two words of the Lord's Prayer, the little prayer we say together closing these meetings, mean exactly what they say. The first two words are, Our Father. Our Father God. You remember when they asked the carpenter, Master, teach us to pray. He said this. He says, after this manner, pray ye, our Father, his Father, your Father, and mine. Now, I believe this to be true. And so, as God's children, I think we all have these characteristics to a certain extent. But only the alcoholic gets them in the combination that we do. Now, just a couple of little things that you will, I'm sure, agree with me on. If there were ever a group of people on the face of the earth who wanted to be a part of this thing called life, it's the drunks of the world. How we wanted to be a part of, and we forever walked alone. I walked alone for 43 years, dying to be a part of this thing called life. But I couldn't make it. And it's because, I think, of the combination of these characteristics. Number one, I have never known an alcoholic, regardless of race, creed, or color, regardless of education or the lack of it, environment to the contrary notwithstanding, I have never known an alcoholic that was not a perfectionist. And I believe it. With that terrific drive for perfection that goes with idealism. This is the thing that gave rise to the little cliche that you heard all your life. This is the best mechanic we've ever had in the shop, but... This is the best doctor that ever hit this part of the country, but... This is the best stenographer we ever had in the office, but she can't make it till about of a Tuesday or Wednesday. That terrific drive for excellence that goes with perfectionism. Now, perfectionism is wonderful when we learn to live with it. I'm just as much a perfectionist today as I ever was. But today it don't bother me. Then it did. It did two things that were very bad for me. It made me set standards for myself that I could not reach. And it would not allow me to integrate myself into the life around me because it was not according to my pattern. I could not become a part of the society around me because I didn't like it. So from the very beginning, I was a rebel, not by choice, but by birth. Secondly, every alcoholic I ever saw was born with the interior awareness that life is a good and a big and a beautiful thing. We came with this. I always knew that life should be like it is right now. But it wasn't. I looked at it and it was cheap and it was dirty and it was ugly. And for 25 years of my life, the only way I could stand what I looked at was to be a half drunk. And don't ever, any of you, tell your psychiatrist what I'm about to say right now. This is the most incongruous thing that ever came out of the mouth of an alcoholic. We are a highly sensitive people. We are a highly sensitive people. Now, isn't this awful? When there we lay, you know, in the gutter, and the pig got up and slowly walked away. This is the way it takes one to know one, you know. This is the reason that only an alcoholic can do much for an alcoholic. Because when your neighbor was stepping over you, you know, he thought you were enjoying it there. He thought you were there because you were enjoying it. But when we see a guy there, we can go over and lay down there with him for nearly, because we know he don't want to be there. He's not there because he wants to be. He hates that life worse than anybody that criticizes him for being there. That isn't the kind of life we want to live. But it's the only kind. The only way that we know how to get rid of that big hurt. We start as kids. Long before we ever had that first drink, building walls to keep from getting hurt. We get to the place where we never let anybody in. Not even our wives, not even our kids. Because we don't want to give anybody a chance to hurt us anymore. We can't stand it. I think this is the reason that the psychiatrists of the world say that we're emotionally immature. Because we have many times the capacity for feeling that they have, and they don't understand. So they label us as emotionally immature. I've talked to almost this many people in Folsom Prison. And you know, Folsom Prison, supposed to be a pretty tough place.
You can't even get in there for murder if it's the first time. You know that? You gotta be an habitual to get in that joint. And I've stood there and watched those men cry right along with me and the tears bouncing off their bellies, and they never made any attempt to stop it. And it wasn't because they were emotionally immature. It was because of the great identity. They felt inside just exactly like I did. And this is one of our great problems. We're a highly sensitive people. Now, for instance, just for fun, I think it'd be a little bit difficult for most normal people to explain to themselves. A guy laying on the floor, so drunk he can't even get up, bawling his eyes out over a beautiful sunset. Well, I would say don't everybody, you know? Because this was exactly what I did. It was just so pretty I couldn't stand it. Well, now you take a combination like this and turn them loose in this world. There are very few things that can happen to people like us. From the day we're born, we're either going to be priests or preachers or nuns, or hopheads or drunks. That's all we can be. Because we can't integrate ourselves into the life around us. And so, from the very beginning, the answer that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous was our destiny. We cannot live without it. Now, when we found alcohol, we thought we had it. Alcohol was the great unifier, because our battle was for unity. That's what we were looking for, unity. And alcohol was the unifier. It allowed us to live in the world without too much trouble. It allowed us to live in our own world and took the rough edges off the world around us. And so for 15 years, I used alcohol for an answer. Now, my very first drink, alcohol was an answer. Proving to me that the problem is already here. Alcoholism is a living problem. It's a living problem. The bottle is its symbol. If alcohol were simply what we're here in the world around us, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind, it would be treatable. Doctors and psychiatrists could get us out of it. But this is a very small percentage, indeed, that can get help that way. Because the underlying cause of alcoholism is a living problem, a basic spiritual unrest. And the only answer that we've ever found from the beginning of time is a basic spiritual rest. The thing that Alcoholics Anonymous provides to those of us who practice its principles in all of our affairs one day at a time. Now, I agree that the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind are mine. I tried 10 years to prove that they weren't. And I proved that you were. I cannot successfully drink whiskey. And I cannot of myself keep from drinking. So my problem is that I am condemned by the obsessions of the mind to drink whiskey. And I am condemned by the allergy of the body to die if I do. And I know that. But I also know that physical sobriety, just physical sobriety, doesn't do it. Because I was physically as sober as I am tonight between every two drunks for 10 years. Physically as sober as I am right now between every two drunks for 10 years. And I always got drunk again and again and again and again and again.
But something happened 23 years and 8 months ago, and I haven't had to have a drink or a pill since then. Now, I would say to you, and I'll quickly get through with this, I've messed around too long. This is the reason I never like to spend very much time on my story, because I get lost in story, and then I don't have time for answer. And the answer's the thing I love in Alcoholics Anonymous, not the story. But I'd ask you a question. Why am I not drunk tonight? This is Saturday night. Who ever heard of drunk being sober on Saturday night? You know, Thursday's kickoff night. Friday, you get her into high, right? Saturday, you paint. Sunday, you sober up so you can go to work Monday. Now, that's some Sunday. You sober up so you can go to work some Monday. Well, why am I not drunk tonight? I'm what? 1,000 miles from home? Something I don't know how far. By the grace of God, through the miracle of AA, I've got a little money in my pocket that I haven't spent yet. And there's liquor in Oregon, I heard. Why am I not drunk? Because I've got the thing I was looking for in the bottle. I got it. Now, what's the thing? I don't hurt in here anymore. That king size hurt's gone. I'm not fighting me or you or life or God or the devil. I am at peace with me and with you and with my very own God. And that's the only reason I'm not drunk. The only reason. You see, the only difference between me right now and 25 years ago is a thing we call the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a state of being. A state of being that's so good that a drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill or a needle can do nothing for me. I've got it. I've got the thing now. And that's the only reason I'm not drunk. Well, why was I drunk 25 years ago? For the same reason, a state of being. A state of being that was so lousy I had to get drunk to get rid of myself. So the problem was a living problem, and the answer is a living answer. Now in my book, there's only one living answer. And we're the most fortunate people on the face of the earth because we didn't come here for that answer. I had spent 30 years in the religions and the philosophies before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to find an answer to a problem that I could not find. 30 years. I had been through all the great systems and all the great Bibles that the world affords, and I thought I knew a lot about it. But the more I learned about them, the drunker I got. Now, I'm quite sure that there was quite a long time in my life that I knew that God wasn't going to let anything bad happen to me. Not because I needed him, but because he needed me. I was quarterbacking on his first team. And he wasn't going to let anything bad happen to me. Well, he pulled a hell of a joke on me because I woke up one morning and the rug was gone and the floor was gone and the ground was gone. And I was in the bottom of the snake pit. Now, I didn't come here, although I had all the problems that I told you about in the first 2 minutes. I didn't come here to get my wife back. I didn't come here to get the love of my kids. I didn't come here to get my job back. I didn't come here to get my health back. I most certainly didn't come here for peace of mind or serenity of purpose. I never heard of it. And I most certainly didn't come here looking for God. I came here looking for surprise, hoping against hope that I might find a way to live without that flint. I had it. And I never did anything that I did for the answers that I told you about. I did them for one answer, because people just like you, drunks who were not drunk, said, if you want what we have, do what we have done, and these are the things we have done. And they told me. And I wanted what they had, and I did the things they told me to do. And that's all I've done for 23 years. And I haven't had to have a drink or a pill since before the first meeting. Since I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And so, everything they told me about came to pass. But everything else came with it. Everything else came with it. I've got the same wife. 24th day of June, we celebrated 44 years in double harness. Now that is absolutely indecent in California. I don't know about here. And by George, you know something? She's turned out to be quite a girl. I've got the same kids. But what a difference. Sometime when I have time, I'll tell you about a little trip I made to Europe last summer just to get acquainted with my youngest. Because after sharing with everybody but him for 23 years, I woke up to the fact that I'd been telling him how to live all his life. And I'd run him clear to Europe. And I had to go over there to get acquainted with him, and I did. And the dam went out, and we share now. We share now. Real good. And that ain't bad. I presently own the business that threw me out. Now that's something I never even dreamed of while I was drunk. And I had me some pretty big dreams. You know, we don't mess around. We're big things. I used to dream of saving the Pope in an earthquake. Now, you don't know how wild that is. I'm not even a Catholic. But I never dreamed of owning that business. But I do. And those are things that are just fantastic. A life that you can't believe. But they're just the beginning. This God of my very own, this guy that walks with me and talks with me, all the time. I mean all the time. This is fantastic. I'm not afraid of him, and I don't think he's afraid of me. We share everything in my life. The good, bad, and the indifferent. And I'm just like a little old knot-headed kid. I do a lousy stunt, and I take it into my closet with me. And I say, look, Dad, look what I did here yesterday. Now, isn't this a hell of a thing for a guy like me? I did it, and I know why. And I don't like it, and you don't like it. And I'm going to do better. And with your help, I'll do a lot better. And I don't. And I never think of it again. And when the good thing happens, I do the same thing. I say, look, Father, isn't this terrific? It can't happen to a bum like me, but it did. And I know where it came from. And I sure think. And I dump that. I think it's just as tough for people like you and me to try to carry the so-called good as the so-called bad. So I dump it all, because I want to enjoy today. You know, life, to be lived properly, has got to be spontaneous. Now, you might not think that I'm very spontaneous, because I've been up here for 2 hours and 15 minutes, I think, now. Or close to something like that, and I've got to get down. So I'm going to try real hard to get down in 5 minutes. Oh, I heard somebody say no, so I'll take 10.
Ha, 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 ha. Hooray for me.
Now, maybe there are those here who will disagree with me, and I don't care. Because I don't think of myself as an oracle. But I do know this, that when I look at me and the life that's mine, and look at my good wife and the life that is hers, and look at my oldest son who has 3 kids and a beautiful wife and the life that's theirs, and my youngest son who has a pretty fabulous life of his own, and look at our lives 24 years ago, it cannot be. It just can't be. There's no way for lives like ours to come out like this. But they have. And the only thing I can do is to thank God and pass the ammunition. That's all I can do. Because this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. For all of us. And I'm the only alcoholic in the bunch. Condition for finding God. Because the first 9 steps of our program are there to squeeze us out of ourselves. To squeeze us out of ourselves. To uncover the thing we've been looking for all our lives. They are the uncovering steps. And anybody that takes them and applies them honestly to himself, when he gets through with 9, is surrendered. They're the surrender steps. They uncover us. Then we can look deep within ourselves and find ourselves, along with Brother Lawrence, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. If you would find God, look deeper than yourself, because the only place you're ever going to find. And this is the great discovery. And then we spend our lifetime, from then on, discarding the things we were conditioned to believe were true about this thing called life. They're absolutely contrary to our own living experience. For instance, when I discovered that I was sober, I started trying to give this thing away. And I can't quit. There isn't anything that I'd rather do than what I'm doing. That's the only reason I'm up here.
But we won't do. That is my business. And it's his business to take care of. And he's done an infinitely better job than I have ever done. And the only thing I can say to you is that I'm so grateful against him. With every breath I draw, I thank the living God that made me for the joy of serving him. Not only to carry the message, the alcoholic is still silent, but to walk down this corridor of life with people like you, sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another, and saying one to another, didn't our hearts burn within us? And he walked with us and talked with us. By the way, God bless you. Thank you.